I'm Frances Cook. Welcome to Making Sense, supported by KiwiBank. Picture this. It's 2:30 on a Wednesday afternoon, and you're not in the office. Instead, you're coaching your son's latest sports team. This time it's soccer, other days it's chess. This is the reality for one New Zealand dad who managed to quit corporate life at just 30. How? A mix of living a very frugal life and property investing. So here's how he did it. Welcome in Nick Gentle, co-owner of I Find Property, I Sell Property, and I Rent Property. A few titles to your name there, quite a little... You've got a lot going on.
Is it a bit happening?
Yeah. Buyer's agent, property coach, self-described frugality geek. Loving this. Let's start with buyer's agent. What is that? What do you do?
Buyer's agent... Oh, first, hello. Thank you for having me on the show. A buyer's agent is they're a licensed real estate agent who works for the buyer. So in New Zealand, property purchasing is all buyer beware. Vendors pay an agent and buyers make an offer and work out in their own way if it's good for them and do their own due diligence and run around open homes and get stressed out and compete in multi offers and all that fun. And so a buyer's agent takes all that away, and we focus on investment property only because as a fee charging business, it's really a lot more straightforward to quantify the value that a buyer's agent provides because we work with clients to their own criteria about what would be a good investment for them. And our clients are sort of out of town or out of country or all Kiwis, new at investing or busy or all of the above and haven't done this before and operating on the philosophy that if you're going to make an investment in property, it's a very big purchase, a lot of debt, you might as well do it really well. We provide a service where you basically buy through the eyes and experience and network of someone who basically just does property. So it's a full concierge service, end to end. You don't need to know anything, have done it before, know anybody, or even really know what you're trying to achieve. We sort of help folks at the start figure that out. And they come out the other end, having made a sophisticated purchase without having to have spent the years in the trenches to even know what that looks like or how to find it.
It's interesting as well, because I feel like buyer's agents are more established overseas. We don't seem to do this as much in New Zealand. Do you run into issues where people don't know what you do or don't know the value of it?
I don't think they understand the word buyer's agent. I mean, property finder is the old school word for, I guess, in New Zealand for somebody who sources investment properties, but it is certainly not a thing here. They're more established in Australia and absolutely in America, where I believe legally there are two agents in any transaction. So when I talk to somebody who's been to America, it's instantly understand what it's about. With someone in New Zealand, there is a little bit of a conversation around, look, here's what we'll do and here's how it works. You know, we had to call ourselves something, so it's buyer's agent. But most of the conversation is simply about, here, look, the problem that we solve for you is this, and the outcome we can get for you is this, and here's how it works, and here's, you know, our fee is similar to a selling agency, just everything's flipped around. Just the fact that buyer's agents are not so prevalent here, certainly not for home buyers, doesn't tend to matter once we get into that dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll bet as soon as people realize there's someone they can have on their side, because it is one of those things. I talk to a lot of people who are, especially when they're getting into property for the first time, whether it's first home buyer or a new property investor, I think it can be really overwhelming. I want to touch on that more soon. First, I want to go back to sort of the beginning with you and how you got into all of this in the first place. Are you someone who was always interested in money? Was it the sort of thing that your parents talked about when you were growing up?
I was interested in it, but my parents certainly didn't talk about it. My parents are school teachers. And I was actually chatting in the car today with someone on speakerphone, of course, if there's any, you know, traffic wardens listening.
For legal purposes, this is all done entirely legally.
For legal purposes only. Yeah. For those of you who do the same. But, you know, we didn't have dinner table conversations around commerce and business and tax and building up equity and all of those things. My parents are school teachers, so we talked about education and the school system and things like that. What I did get from my parents was a money mentality around being good with the money that I've got. So, frugality, it wasn't the word we used. It was just living within your means. And that never left me. And it was really, really helpful as I started to invest, because the money that I earned from investing and working and doing stuff went a lot further, because the size of the lifestyle that I had to prop up never blew out in line with, you know, me expanding my asset base and income and stuff like that. So I didn't really get the money bug, if there's a bug, from my parents. I was just interested. I picked up an interest, started reading the odd book. And then when I moved to Japan when I was 22, I think. And wound up working in IT and finance and banking. It's just, you know, you start to pick up different ideas. And what really pushed it along was I fell into this finance services industry on the IT side, but it's still the same amount of pressure. And it's quite negative pressure, I found. The work was interesting, but I had no passion for the subject and just, you know, being banking. So I started looking at property as a way to have a bit more flexibility down the line. I didn't know what it would look like. I was like in my early 20s, mid 20s. And also just, you know, holidays. Japanese people don't take big holidays. And I figured if I wound up marrying somebody in Japan and they had a family, then 10 days a year for one set of grandparents would leave the country to see their grandkids didn't sound like a good deal. Also, I wasn't able to go anywhere else. So property just seemed to be a way to build up something that in future would be, you know, useful in terms of some flexibility and choices. That was it. It was just vague. And then I figured it out.
Do you remember what sparked that interest in property specifically? Because to go from, as you say, dinner table conversations about education to being really interested in property at, you know, your young 20s, that's quite young to be getting into it. Was there, you know, do you think it was sort of a broader sort of cultural interest in property that you picked up on? Was it a friend that you talked to or a book that you picked up? Do you remember what sparked that interest there?
I believe, and this will be the same for many people, I believe the first book I read was Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Oh, yes. A classic.
A classic, which is a bit cheesy, but sort of gives some, and again, it's simplistic. I only had simplistic ideas, but it gives the idea of making money while you sleep and your money working for you. And then you had this whole series around the cash flow quadrant, like, you know, employee, investor, business owner, and one other one. And I think it was just that. And my work wasn't super exciting. And I was sort of just, I wasn't that fulfilled. And I thought this would be interesting. And I got the entrepreneurial bug, like online businesses, and taught myself how to make websites. And I was making the odd website for people and selling it. And it was around the GFC. And I was quite lucky. Japan was quite fortunate to be a country that rode through the GFC with a lot less impact than the other markets. And I had the yen was very strong. And I was, if you go back and look at it, the yen went up insane amounts versus other countries. So all of a sudden I had a lot more Kiwi dollars. And it's just Kiwi property was relatively cheap, and I just started. But it definitely came out of reading a few books, and then I just got into online businesses. I remember joining a couple of online communities around building businesses and did a few courses, and nothing really landed until I got into property and realized I sort of could understand it all, because I had a mathsy, techie kind of, the numbers all sort of logically made sense, and I could visualize portfolios and leverage and things a little bit, still with no actual experience and having not gone through a cycle or anything. So that was sort of just something I latched onto, really, that gradually became a business. We were buying, I found somebody, I bought a couple of rental properties from over in Japan. After a few months, I still wasn't rich, having bought two properties. Who would have thought? So I looked up what they call property trading, where you buy properties and then fix them up and sell them. So I found somebody in New Zealand who was doing that, and I got in touch, and he said, no, I'm busy. And then I got in touch again, and we had a chat, and we sort of had this little business going where I would buy properties that he found that he could then sort out problems with and improve and sell. And we sort of ticked along doing that. And that was really the start of it all. And I used all of this online businessy course stuff that I'd been plugging away with, turned that into a website, turned it into a mailing list, did all the stuff that, you know, you're supposed to do. Yeah, it sort of grew from there. All these different, it was just a case of doing something, and then it worked out enough to continue to grow it.
Amazing. So let me know if I've messed up any parts of the timeline here. So you're over in Japan, global financial crisis happens, asset prices not doing great things, particularly in property, but Japan wasn't doing too badly. So you thought, okay, from Japan, I'm going to invest in some houses back in New Zealand. Property investing makes the most sense to me out of things I've been looking at. And you were, what was it, 22 when you were doing this?
I was 21 when I moved there. The GFC hit when I think I was 26.
Right.
27. So that's when I think I started to do stuff. I always found that I got a bit restless and started looking for new things to do every year or two. And all of a sudden, I don't know, I'd drift along with my job or whatever I was in and then wanted to change things up. So I think I could just feel there was an opportunity. But again, being 20 in my 20s, I couldn't understand the scope of a lot. So really, it was just about trying to create some passive income for the future and doing some short-term trades to raise cash to do that, you know, on top of the savings that I had in Japan. That was a way to make it happen. And that turned into, you know, a business with customers. It wasn't going to be a business with customers, but I found I enjoyed that. And then I found, much to my surprise, that I had a knack for explaining this whole property, how it all fits together, to people who were perhaps newer at it, and describing all of this and making it easy for them to access it and understand it. And really just being able to do that as what I've built out and with, you know, obviously a team and business partner into this buyer's agency business that we have today. Who would have thought that English, the most important subject in school, I was supposed to be good at maths, and yet it's writing and speaking.
Isn't it funny? I look back at school speeches and things, and I'm like, that actually ended up being one of the things that I used the most, because obviously I do a lot of speaking on the microphone, but also in person. And I'm like, God, I hated it so much. And I was like, what's the point of this? Isn't it funny, the things that come up that end up being useful later in life?
Very, very powerful. I think it's being interested in what you're talking about makes a difference, as opposed to being told that you're talking about the, you know, reproductive cycle of some native grasses.
Oh, God, exactly. It also strikes me, you know, you were talking about, you were interested in, you'd been looking at, you know, online business courses, things like that. And you landed on property because that made the most sense to you. That sort of matched how your brain worked. You could look at portfolios and numbers and things like that, and it all made sense to you. I feel like that's an underrated part of the money journey for different people, is that we all have different strengths, different personalities, different things that we find easy or hard. And people will sometimes say, what's the best investment? There are so many good investments, can be so many good investments. But what you landed on was, this one made sense to you and made sense with how your brain works. How important do you think that is for people?
You either have to do something that you can understand how, why what you're buying is worth buying and be relative to your strengths and something that you're good at. For investment, you can outsource that to advisors. So if I was to buy shares, I wouldn't go and pick them. So I think as an investor, you're separating investing from business. So if you're building up a business to create extra income outside of your job, something that you're already good at that solves a problem for other people is the logical thing to try first, particularly if you're bootstrapping, because you can always just do one client, one job, and see how it goes. Very much a smaller commitment than buying a business and committing all in. So you can build things up slowly and just try things out. And if you're intrinsically or have some skill or understanding or background or what have you, it makes it a lot easier and cheaper and faster to try different ideas out. So for example, I can make a website because I did IT at university, even though I never really, I did project management as a career, but if you can program computers, you can make a website. It's a lot easier than most of the stuff they teach you. So I make all of our websites, and I do it because I can tweak a website in 2 hours to look exactly like I want and don't have to pay thousands of dollars and go into waiting queues and whatever. So I was able to try different things out really, really fast without investing huge amounts of time and money into systems and, you know, paying someone $200 to move a square 5 pixels up or left or down or all of that stuff. So I think I'm getting off topic. So I did the property thing turned into a business because I could marry me understanding property and me being able to make websites and do this technology stuff with having a business partner who couldn't do all of this stuff but knew real estate. And then between us, we covered the whole set of jobs that needed to be done to run an online business around property. So we did. And so don't be afraid to go out and get somebody to help out. But make sure you get someone who doesn't exactly overlap you, unless you want to spend a lot of money filling in the gaps that neither of you guys can cover.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. I mean, to go into the property investing side of it, you started, obviously, property prices had gone down when it was the global financial crisis, but it still wasn't free. And, you know, you're in your mid-20s, not a time when most people are flush with a bunch of cash. I imagine the first investment is the hardest. You know, you've got fewer assets to sort of carry you through. You're at an earlier stage of life. You probably have less cash than you will have later. And particularly property, you do need quite a bit up front. So how did you get the money ready so that you could take that leap? And how do you think other people can get prepared for that first investment? How do you get the finances together?
Yeah, my first impression was the worst deal I ever did. So I don't know.
Oh, great.
An opportunity cost based on what I know now. I'd be worth twice as much. The live within your means upbringing was very, very helpful. In Asia, particularly in finance and IT circles, it is in your 20s, it is a high spend lifestyle. People are eating out a lot. People go out to bars and restaurants and clubs and this and that. I did a little bit of that, but I think every time before I was did IT, I taught English for a year, which is, you know, you're paid a pittance, and I managed to pay off most of my student loan, or half of it, I think, on a wage that's below minimum wage in New Zealand, just by cooking. And I used to walk to save the bus fare, and only going out to a bar once a week and taking $30 because, you know, it would buy me 5 beers back then and things like that. And I think I didn't upgrade my lifestyle every time I upgraded my pay packet, or I had it lag a bit. And so I always managed to have a bit of a, you know, save 30, 40% of what I earned simply because I was living like an English teacher when I was a low-wage IT person. And I went to a mid-wage IT person. I lived like a low-wage IT person. And my partner, who I met when I was 24 and now I'm 26, is, I don't know if it's better or worse than me in terms of being very careful with money and or good with money. And so that was I'm a blessing because I felt no pressure to upgrade. That helped a huge amount because I'd go away and live my life for a few months and then come back and I'd have a few $1,000 in my bank account. And then, you know, I'd do the odd website and just put that in the bank account and stuff. So a few things helped me. So that was the biggest. And then the yen strengthened. So I sent it back and I got more dollars for my yen. So I recognized that and took that opportunity. And I think it was a little bit easier back then. I think I needed a 20% deposit. And it was certainly, the banks weren't really looking at income so much as they were cash, like how much deposit you had. So I probably would have qualified for the loans, but they were more focused on just the fact that I had some capital to put in. But really, I think the first 3 or 4 years were because any spare money that I had, I just threw into this thing. And because I was could live, I found ways to have a really fun life without spending much. So I'd, instead of going to Thailand for a weekend, I'd go hiking or I'd play sports, baseball and cricket and other things over there. There's expat leagues for cricket and I was played in a couple of baseball teams. And, you know, you go and play baseball on a Saturday afternoon and then have, you know, a couple of beers and catch the train home. You've spent $10 and you've had a weekend sort of thing. So it wasn't like I sat around rationing the, you know, bananas or something, but it was really just about maintaining that. I think the good mindfulness around money through that career upswing in earnings through my 20s, to the point where then doing the business here actually started to throw off a little bit of extra money, which helped sort of speed it up.
Yeah, well, I think it's funny, isn't it? The term frugality, it almost has a bit of an image problem, because I think you say you're being frugal and people think of cutting back and missing out.
Rob, you stay home and darn your own socks on the weekend instead of...
Right, exactly.
You're wearing grandma's dress.
Yeah. Do you feel like, and genuinely, do you feel like you missed out on anything from that stage in your life when you were quite frugal?
No, because, I mean, I don't know. Probably had a few less overseas holidays and I lived in cheaper apartments. But I was always out doing stuff. I speak Japanese and I did it in high school. I did a year, my seventh form year. So it's that year 13 for younger generations. Went to a high school in Japan. So I spoke Japanese. And so I could live in Japan as a Japanese person. And contrary to popular belief, it's not actually a high wage society. And so I was just normal over there. And Japanese are very, very good at saving. So I found that I plugged myself into the Japanese part of Japanese life. And I had a few Western friends, but I largely avoided the party districts around Tokyo and stuff, with the odd exception of a work dinner or, you know, my expat cricket team once every 2 or 3 months. And so while I missed out on probably being mixed up in that a lot, I was mixed up in a lot of other stuff, having a great time, and just happened to cost a lot less because, you know, you got 120 million people and that was just fine. You go out for drinks and you spend $25 instead of 150 or whatever the expats are. So I didn't miss out on anything at all. I had a great time.
What are the things that you are okay with and actually think are better, cut back to the bone? And what is the things, is there anything you ever wouldn't cut back on?
I eat very cheaply. I think I tend to just go to supermarket, buy whatever meat, you know, it's on special, and I'll go like 20 or 30 things I make, and none of them cost very much. And that's not cutting back to the bone of like white 95 cents a loaf, unhealthy bread, you know, really chemically infused stuff. It's simply buying ingredients instead of going out and buying meals. Certainly in Japan, I got that habit and it was cheap to eat out over there, but that certainly, you know, in New Zealand, it's very expensive to eat out and drink out and cooking at home. And you can do that on an absolute shoestring budget if you want, and probably very well. But I never feel like I'm missing out. And if I want to eat something, I'll just go and buy it and make it. Things I don't cut back on. I don't tend to discount, so clothing and footwear and shoes and stuff that just, this is probably a habit from living overseas. I'm 6'2" and I just cannot fit anything in Tokyo. So I just got used to buying all my clothes once every year or two when I was home. And the year I went cheap, I kind of ran out mid-year. It all sort of dissolved. So there's a lot of stuff around like that. If you're going to use something a lot, go and buy a good one, whatever it is, like a tool, clothes, shoes. Like I play tennis, so I have a $350 or $400 tennis racket. I don't buy a cheap one because I'm going to use it every week. It's crappy. I don't buy stuff for one-off use. I tend to borrow. So like, you know, if we're going to, I don't know, go out for a party and it's themed, I'll go and rent the thing or borrow it off a friend. I'm not going to go out and have a thing full of one time whatever. If I need to do something in my garden, I'll go and borrow it off a friend. And because I'm going to do it, and then I give it back. Those are probably my distinctions. If we think about it, stuff I use all the time, I tend to invest in stuff I really use or is one-off. I'll either just avoid it or borrow it. There's a lot of, our houses are very full of schlock.
I think that community is an underrated way to save money in general, because when you think about it, like, people often talk about, oh, you need to DIY this and that, and it can save you so much money. Yes, but sometimes the tools you need to do that DIY are expensive. And yet I think about purely in our own situation, you know, we've got both sets of my husband's parents and my parents are both near Ishbi. And we are constantly swapping tools between the households as we all do various like jobs around the house or the garden or whatever. And by having our own little stashes that we swap between us, we can DIY things that would be very expensive to bring in contractors, but we're not having to buy all of the tools ourselves. Having that sort of community, people who you can beg, borrow, steal from, that is actually a little bit of a frugal hack, isn't it?
Well, I guess it's like how people have always lived, and we sort of went away from that. And I think there's a plethora of cheap, use it once, if you're lucky, kind of stuff out there. But that's one of the problems with the world is this disposable, temporary nature of a lot of possessions these days.
Yeah. And cost per use actually then ends up being really high, but people don't think of the cost per use so much, do they?
Yeah, and I have a little bit of a greeny aspect to my thinking. I really don't like buying things that are destined to be used for not very long and then thrown out.
Yeah.
Be that a tool and, you know, what do they call it, fast fashion or any of that stuff. I just think you can go borrow it or rent it or something, and that just saves a piece of plastic from going into landfill, hopefully.
You managed to quit the corporate world at 30, which is incredibly young. Was that, had you hit financial independence, or did you just know you could sort of take care of yourself and other means by then? What happened for that to be an option for you?
I think this is where everyone's going to go, oh, this guy's a fake and switch off. So I think I was rich dad, poor dad. I was sick of what I was doing, and I was trading these properties in New Zealand with my friend Mark, and it was going okay. And I had a few rentals, not many. And I think I had passive income. I might have had like a dollar a year more than I earned. I was nowhere near financially secure enough to do what I did. But I had enough to like limp along in my like minimal spend, go camping and eat noodles kind of happiness, life in the mountains. Certainly if I'd had two kids and a big mortgage, I would have had to gut it out for a bit longer. It was my 30th or 31st birthday. I forget. I'd just been 2 months earlier, I'd been given a bonus. I'd gone and spent it all on tailor-made suits that one of them is still in my closet in plastic, ready to be worn. I just have to lose 5 kilos. I think I just realized I had enough. Everything was sort of there. I had a bunch of savings as well as this, so I could just limp along for a bit and it would be okay. And then I could always opt back in. Now, I had a few things that helped me with this. So first of all is my wife is also entrepreneurial. She is a musician. She's a gospel singer. She set up her own business from a hobby similar to me. Her hobby started earlier from 18, and she built up a school for adults to come and learn how to sing. And then she branched that out, franchised it actually. So she was doing okay. Not big money, but it was enough to cover half of our costs. We just split bills. We've never done a joint bank account. And we work, I was like, oh, you know, if it all goes badly, we'll be fine. And just as when she was starting up, I covered it all for a while. So I thought, that was all right. And I didn't like what I was doing, and I didn't really know and I thought the property stuff would keep going forever. I'd read, I think, the 4-Hour Work Week by a guy called Tim Ferriss. The key I took away from that was, look, there are heaps of ways to make money. You can freelance, you can start a business, you can go and get another job, you can, you know, I had pretty good skills, fluent Japanese, so I knew I could go and get work if I needed it. the properties were cash flow positive because that was my investing style and wanted to spend some time with my kid. I think Joe was two. Just generally felt like if this doesn't work out, I got a runway and I can figure it out and go back to it. So it was not well planned. I did not have I've got double my living costs. So I know all of this. I've got my health insurance lined up. I've got this and this and this and this and that and the other stuff. And like, I wouldn't coach anyone to do what I did. What it did give me though was truckloads of time. So for everyone who's sitting there fantasizing about what they would do when they retire, I lasted 6 weeks. So I went camping for 2 weeks. Then I literally walked around town restless until this have to do stuff energy like dissipated. And then I suddenly realized that every single connection that I had was at work for 50 hours a week, Monday to Friday, including my wife on her business. She was super stoked because I could look after the kid and clean the house. But I sort of had to figure out what to do with my time because, I mean, you know, there's only so many mountains you can walk up and down and stare at or sit in a stream and contemplate the future. That was when I really started to dig into business growth and opportunities and ideas and things. And that was when I pushed the growth of the property, the small property business, and really started to try and grow it because I had a lot of time and a lot of no pressure and I could experiment. And if all didn't work, I could, I don't know, go get a job again.
Isn't it interesting? I've talked to other people about this before where I feel like every step you make along the path of financial independence makes the next ones easier. You know, people often start out and they say, oh, you know, it's so hard. I don't see how I'm going to get ahead. And it is good. Those first few steps are the hardest and all of them build up on each other to make the next few ones easier. Because from my perspective, listening to your story, it sounds like, you know, you were really good at being frugal. You'd started investing. You had a level of financial independence where you technically could retire early. And of course you did, then got bored.
Yeah.
Love that.
That's not part of the plan.
But you know, you could have lived this very much smaller frugal life and you would have been fine. But then you gave yourself the gift of time and breathing space and the ability to plan. And it let you launch these other businesses that I'm sure have really helped grow your wealth. From where I'm sitting, it looks like giving yourself that breathing space and that time was crucial to then doing the big move that really built your wealth. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
It is. That wasn't on my mind when I did leave. And one of the things I learned afterwards is, look, if you're in a miserable work situation, you know, you can just change your work situation. Like, I talk to people, I do a bit of speaking and I say that, like, I did all this, but I could have just switched careers and probably been very happy and continue to invest and do other things. But look, I took the path I took and it did give time and it gave me time to experiment without crushing fear of being able to provide for my family immediately. And if stuff didn't go well, then I'll try other things. And I think that's very beneficial. You can scale up something that's working and it can take a little bit of time to find something that works.
Yeah, exactly. And it made a huge difference to your family life as well, didn't it? I mean, I love what you say about your wife was stoked because you could look after the kids and clean the house. Like, that sounds like the dream.
There you go. It's a baby.
Yeah, exactly. But it did. You could actually become far more involved in your family life, couldn't you? On a serious note, you know, tell me what that was like. What changed there and how did it feel?
Two big changes happened. The first one, and I think we'll get to the later one when we moved to New Zealand. So I used to get up, leave the house at 7:30 and get on a train and go an hour into the city to go to an office. So I was there for breakfast and I was there for kindy drop off and kindy pick up. And I mean that she could schedule a lot more stuff, which she happily did. And I would do kindy pickups and drop offs and walks and take the kid to the park and stuff. So I don't think the Japanese housewives quite knew what to make of this redheaded fella wandering the streets at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday with a toddler playing on the swings. But yeah, I was super present with my kid and then I could take him away for like camping trips and stuff. So we found a camping spot about 90 minutes out of the city in this gorgeous valley. It's like being in Arrowtown. And I would take, from when he was three, I think he was still in nappies, I would just shoot up there for like 6 or 7 nights and just hang out with him and a couple of other parents. And so just being able to do those kind of things was a real blessing. And even when it, like businesses start to build up again, I took my computer off and just mobile hotspotted and did some emails for a couple of hours, and that was that. Also, I started freelancing. So a friend of mine, I was in a, and I highly encourage people, if you ever get this opportunity, I joined what's called a mastermind group. I don't even know if we called it that. It was just a group of guys. And we would get together once a month and talk about health, family, wealth and investing, and spiritual, which meant mental health, not religion for us. Goals, and we'd set goals each year, and every month you had to get together and report on that. And if you weren't working towards your goals, they ripped into you. But one of the guys in that group, who was an entrepreneur as well, he was like, "Oh, Nick, you're an IT guy. You've got some time now. Can you come by my office and help me with this project for a billing system on my software thing that isn't going well?" And all of a sudden, I was basically back working one day a week, earning half of what I earned in corporate, or 1.5 days a week. And that happened like quite a bit after the initial pullout. So all of a sudden, I was working very much part-time on a very casual basis, earning real okay money, more than enough to live in Japan. So I had this great lifestyle where I could just do whatever I wanted, work on my businesses. And the big thing that meant was that all of the money that came out of the New Zealand side, the property businesses, everything got reinvested. I didn't need to pull anything out and live off of it. Completely unplanned, but again, having the time and capacity, I couldn't have done that when I was working a full-time job. I couldn't have cut back to a third and taken half pay. But all of a sudden, when I realized all my bases were covered, and this just meant that my entire Japan life could be paid for by Tuesday afternoon, leaving the rest of the week and the weekend for me to sort out whatever else I wanted to do, was, you know, pressure's off sort of thing, which was cool.
Yeah. And you've got to be really involved in your son's life throughout his childhood, right? You've got to be a very hands-on dad because of having this freedom over your time, right?
Absolutely. I think if I look back now, that has been the biggest unexpected benefit was, and a lot of it manifested more when I came to New Zealand. So in 2019, my son was going to school. He was in second year of primary school, and Japanese schools are very hardworking, but they're also quite, groupthink's probably the word, very old fashioned education system. Kids line up in rows and the teacher talks and they write. And I'd been to a high school, so I knew it didn't get any better. And so we thought, okay, we'll come to New Zealand and get some English into him. We're already coming down every summer for like 2 months, which was awesome as well. So we came to New Zealand and an email came from the school saying, you know, can anyone coach the soccer team? We're like, all right, I used to play soccer, happy to do it. So I showed up at school. Now in Japan, his soccer team of 9 kids had 3 coaches. They were doing drills, they had ladders, they were doing sprints on ladders, they were doing all sorts of things. They went to academies, it was really organized. I rocked up to his school, they gave me a bag of balls and said, thanks. I was like, wow, cool. And then I went to a practice and there were like 10 of these kids who were all, you know, knee high. And I suddenly had to figure out how to do that. And that was a lot of fun. As an aside, having gone through all of that academy stuff in Japan, my son was super popular with the soccer mates because he was like pretty good as an 8-year-old. And so then he played cricket. Okay, who's happy to be the cricket coach? I'll do that. Not a lot of other dads can rock up at 2:30 on a Wednesday and do it, right? So I was quite lucky. And tennis. Cool. I'll do that. And I liked playing chess. And I tricked him into liking chess because I got his mates into playing it. And then if he wanted to hang out with them, he had to go to the chess tournament. So he started playing chess. And I wound up coaching the school chess team and taking them to nationals and tournaments. So all of a sudden, you know, 4 or 5 different sports and volunteering at different things. I'm the coach, I'm the organizer. There's a lot of admin and a lot of, you know, there's a thankless aspect to it, but there's way more great stuff that comes out of that. And he was so stoked that his dad was there for all of this stuff. Like the one time I didn't coach his soccer team, he was you know, oh, I don't want to play soccer anymore. I think he stopped. Even sports I don't know, like basketball, I wound up because it's just the way Kiwi schools are. They don't have coaches and stuff. So I got to do all of these things. And I'm like, every day I'd leave what I was doing at 2 o'clock and truck down to the school and get ready with whatever balls I needed that day to, you know, even today. We just did a road trip taking 16 kids to Wellington for the New Zealand National Chess, you know, Championships and those kinds of adventures, just Thursday, Friday, yeah, I'll go sort of thing. So just that flexibility around time, which started because I didn't like what I was doing in an office, led to this really deep relationship with a really good, healthy relationship with my son, based around just being there for him and part of all of this stuff. And that's a huge blessing. And I totally appreciate that that is not an option to most families that have to, you know, you have to work and you have to work the hours. And so I'm very, very grateful that that landed in my life, because it wasn't part of the plan, but it was awesome. It is awesome because it's still ongoing.
No, it sounds amazing. I mean, I think that's exactly the sort of thing. It comes up time and time again on this podcast, you know, that money itself might not be important, but it impacts everything that is, right? And being able to use money to build that sort of lifestyle for your family is incredible. So I think people are going to want property tips from you to see if they can follow in your footsteps and build this sort of lifestyle. So you're a property coach now. What do you think most property investors get wrong?
So most property investors, oh, there's so many different things that you can that can get wrong. The biggest one is, so there's obviously two, if you be very simplistic, property, you invest for cash flow and growth. And 97% of investors focus on growth and ignore cash flow. But all of this flexibility.
Just define for us briefly, when we're talking growth and cash flow, what does that mean?
Just capital growth, capital gains. I mean, if you go and look at the Herald website, once a week, there'll be hot suburbs tip for growth 2020.
Price is going up, basically.
Yeah, price is going up. So every article, everybody's focused on the value of their own home increasing. Makes them feel rich. But when you're investing, so obviously you borrow money to do this, and that money comes at a cost. And you want, if you can do transactions to the point where after paying all of your costs, there's more money left over at the end of it, you've got a cash flow positive portfolio. If you've got extra money, then you've got extra options and flexibility in life. So a lot of where I'm being able to enjoy my time, my kid, comes about because I don't have to work to top up property purchases. They top me up.
Right. So basically, if you'd gone for a growth strategy where you're waiting for the price to go up, you might have been stuck paying huge mortgages, not getting as much rent, not having as much cash in the hand, which is what when we're talking about cash flow, it's getting some actual cash in the hand. So you've targeted that cash flow strategy, and that's what's given you freedom.
That is exactly right.
Yeah, nice.
So I think a lot of investors, there's various reasons. One is they look nice, the growth houses, because our family homes are not rental properties. So you feel better and nicer buying them. A lot of them might be brand new, so they are easy. Very, you know, you write a contract and someone goes and builds you a house, but again, it costs you money, some of them. They're in your neighborhood. The old I'd live in that trick, former family homes, that if you were to buy a rental today, you wouldn't buy that because the numbers don't work, but you'll keep it because you used to live in it. So there are a number of reasons that folks wind up in, you know, properties like this. And then the market cycle hype. So we just came out, we're about 2 years removed from a very inflated market where a lot of people just rushed in and bought anything, ignoring all fundamentals because interest rates were supposed to stay down for forever and ever, and I don't think they lasted 12 months. And so a lot of pain in the last few years, primarily from folks who their portfolio was around either bought later, lower yields, etc. One of the other reasons that folks don't do the cash flow thing is it's actually a bit more difficult. So if you want a growth portfolio, just go find a house on a nice street and purchase it. There's your buying done. You do need to put a little bit more into it when you're wanting to, buy a property that rents well. Typically, that's some flavor of improving your asset. adding another bedroom, adding a dwelling at the back, renovating it, making it nicer. So just but making something better than you bought, which is my favorite, two favorite things I like about property investment. One is you can do it with other people's money. You borrow money from the bank. And the second is you can improve your asset, which you can't do that with like shares and things. So if you can do that well, in a careful manner and gradually, you can gradually grow something that's significant. And if you have poor cash flow fundamentals and you might be topping up a mortgage, when you go back to the bank, they'll say, oh, no, sorry, look, you're already at your limit because the property doesn't really contribute enough to the income side of the deal to cover off the amount of the debt that you have on their books. So they said, no, you're done here until you need to save up. And, you know, then you can continue, but that can be quite slow.
So I mean, I think we've got some hints there, but just to make it really explicit, what sort of properties do you target when you're looking for a good cash flow property?
Yep. So I target ones where, okay, first of all, I have an open mind. So I will just go in and look at a house or a property and look at what can be done with it. If my plan is to buy something that I can add another dwelling to, because that's a whole project, I'll be looking obviously for space on the section with easy access around driveways and stuff so that cars can come in and out too. Because typically at the back that you might be putting this one in. And I like the front house to be run down because that means I'll get it at a good price and I can improve it rather than paying for someone else's renovation. That's the main two, flat section, no ground cover, no slopey ground, nothing too difficult. I tend to look at middle level areas. So socioeconomic, I try to avoid the lowest parts of the market. And I certainly avoid the highest for this strategy. And so if I'm looking for that type of property, that will be what I'm after. And if the house at the front or the house, your existing property is in a bad state of repair, that really helps you to make the numbers work because you can improve that, which lifts your value and cash flow. And you can improve by adding at the back. So you've now lifted it in two aspects and your gains start to compound. That whole improving multiple areas of the property is the core of the philosophy and it will be the same no matter what type of property. So a lot of my portfolio now is student rentals. And I buy them when they're derelict old villas in and around university. I spend a lot of time and money remodeling them to add a couple of bedrooms, but then I make them really nice. So fully insulated, ducted heating systems, you know, nice new kitchens, new bathrooms, lots of bathrooms, high ceilings, everything's immaculate. And so I've fixed up what was there and I've added more bedrooms and just generally made it a much, much better property. And it does take a lot of time. It takes a lot of money, that one and the previous one, but you come out of it with something that's because you improved it so much with a rent focus, the costs are covered. And generally, that's the idea. So blocks of flats, upstairs, downstairs, sausage flats, something you can add a rental stream to in some way, problems that you can solve with the existing dwelling that you can do in a cost-effective way. Always look at rental yields. So,
are there any sort of fish hooks on renovations and things? Because I know sometimes people get into the renovation space and sometimes people bite off more than they can chew or they have a great idea or something and they sink too much money into a property for what they're going to get back. Is there pros and cons on that?
Well, it's if you're overcapitalized, it's generally all cons. So my approach is always you got to remember who that you're not going to live in the house. So go down to Bunnings or Mitre 10 and just get nice, solid stuff. And, you know, nice tiles, nice paint, nice appliances, a reasonable kitchen, hardware and curtains. It is a rental property. That's enough. You know, the folks who live in it, it's not their forever home either. So they don't expect plush carpets in an executive home. I think just having that in mind when you start is key. And the other reason people, and look, this has happened to me. The second part is that when you peel back the layers on the onion and you start looking at a renovation, you will find issues that you didn't know about. So I've had two times, didn't learn the first time. I've lifted up the floorboards to have a look at the piles on a part of the house where I couldn't get underneath it and found out that there were no piles.
Oh, God.
Yep. The bureaus were lying directly on the dirt and they were rotten through.
Ugh.
So there's nothing that will bring you to your senses sharper than your builder calling you to say that you now have to build a foundation in situ on a gutted house. And I had a good builder. The first time he called me, before he called me, he called the engineer and he called the council and they had a solution and they all agreed on it. Then he called me and told me how much it was going to cost.
Oh, good man. Hi, I have a problem. I also have a solution and here's how much you're on the hook for. Oh, good man.
Yeah, which does sound like it would scare people, but it's a lot better than we have a problem. What do you think?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think you just have to have a healthy contingency when you're taking on stuff. Either crawl all over the building, pay that extra time and care, or just be prepared for things to go wrong. The other one that people get wrong is they particularly, probably more so these days, and this hasn't happened to me, but it happens a lot. Insurance is harder to get. And so a lot of properties in New Zealand have unconsented alterations and insurers just will not touch them now. So if you've got something or you're looking at something where, you know, you go through the file or the sales agent goes through the file and it says, look, this conservatory or this extension or this sleep out, it's not at this point. You really need to drill down into that. There are ways to fix things. There's ways to fix anything, but you'll find that your insurer will object to it and then your lender will object to the fact that you don't have full insurance. So people are getting stuck now trying to sell the properties that 15 years ago the insurers didn't really bat an eyelid at, probably because they weren't told about it. So that's a fish hook that's coming up more and more. But again, there's opportunity if you know how to solve those issues and the other buyers don't, then you can pick up a property and solve those issues.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true. Use whatever skills you've got on hand. All right, we're pretty much running up on time, but I put out a request to my social media followers and said, look, is there anything that you would want to know from a property coach? Masses back. Thank you to everyone who did send through questions. And I found a lot of them landed on a similar theme. So I've collected the ones that came through over and over again. And I think what we might do is just a real quick fire round. I'm not talking, you know, one word answers, but a couple of sentences on, you know, your top thoughts on it. What do you reckon?
Go for it.
All right. Excellent. Why property over other investments such as shares?
It was what I could do. When I was overseas, I wasn't even allowed to open a KiwiSaver account.
Oh, wow.
So I looked at things and it was interesting. I like the idea of fixing a house. It feels to me like Lego, building a portfolio up and improving things and recycling capital and stuff. So I like the ecosystem, but really it was difficult for me to do KiwiSaver as well. So I just put the money where I could.
Fair. All right. Lots of people asked a version of how do you use the equity you've built up in your home to then launch into investment property?
This might be more than two sentences. So essentially with your bank will want you to maintain a 20% equity buffer in your own home. So you're looking at surplus equity above that 20%. Then you go to the bank and you say, look, I've got this surplus equity. Can I go out and buy a rental with it? Use that as a deposit. Bearing in mind that investment properties have a high, I think it's 30 at the moment. It tends to go up and down between 20 and 40, depending on where the market is at for rental properties. So you'll need to have surplus equity that is of a size enough to form a deposit to go and buy a house. So for a very simple example, if you've got a $500,000 home and you owe $100,000 on it, 20% of $500,000 is $100,000. That extra $300,000 of equity could in theory be used as collateral to help you go and buy another rental property, and then they would look at your ability to service loans and other factors before they work out how much you can potentially purchase. The thing that folks need to bear in mind, and this is why I invest for cash flow, is even though you're using equity in your home to pay that deposit, that new mortgage is still 100% financed. So you really have to be mindful of your borrowing costs when you go into that, because you can wind up in a situation where, you know, you're paying a lot of money to cover these mortgages, where a lot of folks found themselves, particularly in the last couple of years. And in a flat market, that can be quite demotivating. You essentially subsidize folks' rents when house values are flat. So that's my big thing against going for a capital gains type strategy, is that in between drinks and when the market's not doing anything or going backwards, it's pretty miserable going. And then if you lose a job or someone gets sick or someone needs a new hip or you need a new car or someone needs to go on a sports trip, all of a sudden you question, why did you do this in the first place? Whereas if the property was just a more profitable going concern from day one, you can have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, you do not want your investment, your big, exciting investment, to become a millstone that holds you back from life. That's really tough when that happens.
No, most fights are about money, right? So you don't want this to become a
negative in your life.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Similar, how many properties do you need for it to be worth it?
I don't think about numbers of properties. And I think there are people I run these Facebook groups where people talk about the number of deals they own and all of this. And I just look at a number. So work out your cost of living. Try and have more than that. I have a property in central Wellington that rents, because it's two flats and they're five bedrooms each, rents for over $100,000 a year. And my first rental, I think, earned $15,000 a year. So if I looked at only number of properties, I would need, you know, seven or eight of those to cover off the other. So really, it's about the money that's left over at the end. You could go and buy one or two big commercial properties and not need to do anything else. And many investors actually do start small, and then as they grow, they sell smaller, cheaper properties and consolidate into higher earning, bigger deals.
Now, this one's slightly curly, but I'm sure you've heard it before. How do you feel about the ethics/morals of property investing versus the issue of housing for all?
I've heard that before. I think you've got to treat... I try to open my talking gigs by reminding everyone there that, you know, we're privileged to be in the position of owning multiple homes, which is just an amazing, like, financial position for someone to be in. Whether they do it or not is on them. And you have to do it well. So your tenants are your customers. Anything that is broken or damaged or in disrepair, you have to fix it. It doesn't matter what your financial situation is. If their heater breaks, you fix it, because they are paying you to rent their home. You're providing a home. So I think a lot of tenants are viewed as, and I'm in these Facebook groups and stuff, is some people view them as an inconvenience, and it's, you're living in my investment sort of things. And I just, you got to switch that mentality around with folks and say, look, we are in the business of providing housing. And look, there are always going to be people who need to rent a house, because we don't all leave home fully formed with house deposits and abilities to pay mortgages and the desire to put down roots and own a home everywhere we lived. I rent vested. I never owned a home in Tokyo. So my first home I ever lived in that I owned, I think I bought it age 30 something when I was back here. And so renting is very convenient. If you can just start operating from a position of gratitude and obligation, and that you will benefit financially from doing that well, that is a big step, and it will remove a lot of the negative stories, I think, from, you know, the worst tenants and the worst landlords are the ones that that make the news. So that's generally how I look at it. And there are ways to help others into homes, and through rent-to-buy schemes and shared equity schemes. And I'm a big fan of all of those. Long may there be more of it. I have a concern in New Zealand that we've got so much red tape and regulation around building that is certainly doing more to pull up the drawbridge for people to get into housing than investors, because the replacement cost of the house I'm living in is of a 100 square meter house, it's probably $500,000, which is just insane. And it's a very, very basic house. I don't know if that covers it all.
Yeah. No, I think that was an excellent question. You had me gripped there. All right, on to the next. Sorry, I was totally lost on what you were saying. It was great. The next one, we've got two more. Do you have to have a tolerance for stress? I have heard horror stories about bad tenants.
Yeah, I have very good insurance brokers and very good property managers. So I'm a huge believer in outsourcing. I don't DIY. I will hire an architect, a property manager, a building inspector, a builder, a painter, a mortgage advisor, an insurance advisor, and they all do stuff very, very well. And my job is to make sure that the deal that I'm putting together pays everybody and pays me and provides a good house. Have a property manager who understands the Residential Tenancy Act through and through and has good systems and has good vetting systems and gets on top of small problems before they become big problems. And have a good insurance business and make sure that you have got the right cover and that it's being reviewed annually. I don't shop direct for anything. I don't go to the insurer and try and shop around. I don't certainly don't manage myself. I would be a terrible property manager. And if you're still going to have bad stuff happen, but you mitigate the risk a lot more. And also high quality housing. So people, you're going to get the odd bad egg, but a lot of folks will treat your house like you give it to them and you look after it. If you don't invest in your house and it's scungy and this and that and it's nasty and then you get upset because some curtains are ripped. I mean, come on, you can do better. And then you'll get more likely to get folks who are going to look after your property, move into the property. And if you fix everything immediately, then they're more likely to do their bit. I want to add one other thing to the earlier question.
Yeah.
About the ethics side of things.
Yeah, sure.
So if you're investing for cash flow, then you're not really competing with first home buyers because the typical family home on a section doesn't actually make a good cash flow investment. So I look at flats and blocks of units and pension units and student accommodation and other things is typically the type of property I invest in. So I don't really see that there's a competition there because students don't want to buy a house and, you know, the pensioners who need a house, they can rent it and it's very affordable.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, lucky last. What's your favorite type of property? Are we talking apartments, townhouses, something else?
Everyone has their own style. And if you go online and you look around, you'll see people who have made it work with every single style. So I like inner city, around the university, older properties that I can renovate and rent out to young people, simply because they do well financially. Generally, if you can avoid the 18-year-old boys who are there for the first year and providing some nice accommodation, folks will stay for a few years. I don't know why I do this to myself, but I have a thing for those old villas. I just think they're gorgeous.
You're a sucker for punishment.
Absolute punishment, because when you rip off the walls and you look at all the rot and everything, you think, oh, why'd I do this again? But I just think they're pretty. So that seems to be the type of thing I go for.
I love it. All right. Well, we have gone well over time, but I was really enjoying the conversation. So absolutely no regrets here. Look, if people want to know more from you, where can they find you?
A few places. So ifindproperty.co.nz is the buyer's agency website. That's probably the main online outpost. I'm one of the admin of a large Facebook group called the Property Investors Chat Group, which is about 70,000 people in it. You can email me at nick@ifindproperty.co.nz. You won't find me on Twitter, sorry, or Instagram. I don't even know. I think I've got an account.
Much better for your mental health, I'm sure.
Yeah. So one of the things, and this is probably an interesting one to chip in right when you're trying to finish the conversation, when I started doing property full time, I don't do a lot of property stuff myself. Like I don't geek out and go and follow topics and get into huge big discussions so much. When I'm on Facebook, I'm typically trying to help someone and answer their questions. You know, when I'm away from not doing this, helping others to invest or doing my own stuff, I'm playing tennis or camping or doing stuff with my kid. So I don't have a Twitter thing where I just blast out my thoughts about everything going on in the property market in my free time, because my free time I'm probably on the couch reading a book.
I'm sure your brain is much, much healthier for that.
It's nice. Yeah, you got to turn it off. Otherwise, it's the thing about coaching is you're giving people your undivided attention, but by the end of the day, that's all given. So you got to do something else.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all your tips and tricks with us. That's Nick Gentle from iFind Property. Now, if you have a question for me on this or anything else to do with money, obviously we crammed a bunch of your questions into this episode, but we can always do more in future. So get in touch. Francis Cook NZ on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Also heaps more money content on there for you. And there's also my newsletter, The Money Memo, for a free money tip in your inbox every week. You can find that in the show notes and also my website, franciscook.co.nz. But most importantly, make sure you subscribe to Making Sense on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube these days as well, because that is where you will stay up to date with everything money. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.